Chapter 4. History and Freedom. Freedom as an empirical issue. Modern philosophical thinking about freedom often involves asking whether freedom exists at all. If everything that can be observed in the physical world functions in terms of deterministic laws, as modern science largely assumes it does, why should the physical object, human being, be any different? What we regard as our freedom, which is the basis of our decisions on our actions, is, in these terms, located in the same chains of causality as everything else that happens, even though it may not seem that way to us. In the everyday world, in contrast, freedom is associated with the ability to do what one wants, unhindered by other individuals or by the state. That such freedom has to involve limits is generally accepted, but the nature of those limits is often ferociously contested. In philosophical accounts of these issues, a contrast is sometimes made between negative freedom, the absence of limits and constraints from outside oneself, and positive freedom, the capacity to act and exercise one's free will in a rational manner. The latter, of course, depends on being in a society which does not constrain my capacity to decide for myself. In a related vein, a distinction is made between questions of political freedom, which involve the constraints a society may legitimately impose on its members, and the metaphysical question we opened with of freedom of the will and whether it really exists. Adorno's responses to the issue of freedom are interesting, not least because they question whether the directions just outlined really grasp the significance of freedom in the modern world. His focus on the Holocaust can suggest why this might be the case. Are we to understand the way in which the perpetrators enacted unimaginable cruelty on such a scale in terms of people exercising their free will? For Adorno, freedom is a category which is historical through and through. One cannot, for example, formulate and stipulate a concept of freedom once and for all, in the way philosophy has almost always done it. What is often seen as a metaphysical issue is, then, actually something empirical that we all experience at various times. The contradiction between freedom and determinism is one of the self-experience of subjects, sometimes free, sometimes unfree. This might seem just to be referring to political freedom, but this is not the case, though he thinks the aim of such freedom is vital. Adorno does not focus on the metaphysical question of free will, precisely because it can exclude consideration of the fact that freedom and history are inseparable. There are good philosophical reasons for his approach. The very notion of a society that is more than just an aggregate of human beings requires the notion of freedom. Without any conception of freedom, organized society could hardly be theoretically justified. If one denies the existence of freedom, the following problem arises. In the situation of a complete determinism with no gaps, criteria of good and evil would be just completely meaningless. You couldn't even ask about them. In seeking to reduce freedom to something else, you have to invoke something that gives content to the term. How do we have any comprehension of what it is that doesn't exist? Telling protesters against a repressive government that what they seek doesn't really exist because everything is determined makes no sense. Even in the case of political freedom, the question remains as to why such freedom matters at all. And this, as Adorno says, is a result of people's experience of freedom and unfreedom. The idea that what appears to us to be freedom can really be explained by the correct physicalist account of the functioning of nature simply omits what is at issue, namely the roles freedom plays in human experience and action. Freedom is, then, dialectically constituted. freedom becomes concrete in the changing forms of repression, in the resistance to these. There is as much freedom of the will as people wished to liberate themselves. Freedom itself is so tied up with unfreedom that it is not only inhibited by it, but has it as a condition of its own concept. The changing forms of this relationship can only be understood by looking at history, not by advancing a metaphysical argument for freedom of the will. Such an argument would be merely abstract, because it cannot encompass differing historical experiences of repression and the specific forms taken by resistance to the repression. Freedom and human practice. Freedom is, of course, also a precarious notion, because thinking or feeling that you are free can involve the danger of self-deception. This raises the question of how it is possible to know if you really are free. For Adorno, taking account of the possibility of self-deception is vital to thinking about how ideology affects modern politics. Kant sees human behavior as linked to our natural impulses, and so as largely determined by something other than freedom. We don't choose to have impulses, or which impulses we have. Thinking you are free because you are doing what you want can therefore, as Rousseau argued, actually mean you are slave to your passions. Kant goes so far as to argue we can never know if what we do is autonomous, because even doing good can be based on our action making us feel better, so is not done solely in terms of obeying a moral imperative. In order to bolster his notion of freedom, he talks of a causality through freedom that is required to set a new causal chain in motion, and which does not depend on a prior causal chain, of the kind that underlies our natural impulses and the laws of non-human nature. Adorno, however, argues that we would only be free in Kant's sense if we did not fulfill our causally based natural inclinations, and that Kant therefore requires the complete absence of nature in our moral actions. If one just insisted on saying, there is admittedly something like freedom in the absolute, but as soon as I move into the limited realm of experience, there is only causality, and you can't find any freedom, then nothing at all would be done for practice itself with this announcement of this principle of freedom. For practice is always the practice of empirical human beings, which relates to empirically given circumstances. As such, this double difficulty, that something like the sphere of the human can exist neither in absolute lawfulness nor in absolute freedom, is really the most profound reason for Kant being forced into the paradoxical construction of a causality through freedom. Reducing nature to the realm of what is subject to necessary laws is, as we have discussed, precisely what Adorno seeks to question. At the same time, freedom can only become real by going through the compulsion of civilization, not as a retour à la nature. Adorno reads Kant's account of freedom in the manner we have seen him read other aspects of Kant, namely as a symptom of a real contradiction in modern life. Causal explanation functions in this perspective primarily as a means to control nature, including our own nature, in the form of technological, instrumental reason. How is this to be reconciled with the Enlightenment idea that freedom is the basis of meaningful human life? Kant's idea of freedom as self-determination by adherence to social duty can appear as a form of repression in the psychoanalytical sense. Freedom is here another means of controlling nature, our nature, and arguably can make us less free. However, what happens in the most recent times is the externalization of the superego into unconditional conformism, not its incorporation into a more rational whole. A life spent denying the satisfactions of sensuous existence by wholesale subordination of oneself to duty is at odds with the experience of freedom as the overcoming of neurosis-inducing inhibitions, which can be a source of cruelty to others. The truth content of neuroses is that they demonstrate to the I in itself by what is alien to the I, by the feeling of that isn't me at all, its unfreedom. There, where its command over inner nature fails. Neuroses are pillars of society. They thwart people's better potential, and with it, the objectively better things that people could bring about. Kantian morality therefore leads to the following contradiction. In a certain sense, the two contradictory moments of Kantian moral philosophy, namely the idea of freedom and the idea of, one has to say, suppression, above all of the suppression of any natural impulse, the suppression of inclination, the suppression of sympathy, both really only come about for the sake of freedom. The pursuit of happiness is vital for Adorno to how we conceive of human freedom, and it seems incompatible with reason as a universal principle in Kant. As such, the very point of reason itself becomes open to doubt, because Kant fails to answer the question whether the absolute realization of reason would not mean something like the fulfillment of precisely everything that is suppressed by him, because it is part of the determined world of nature. This points to what Adorno sees as the Enlightenment's confusion of freedom with the business of self-preservation, in the name of which socially repressive norms develop. In the same way as he questions the rigid opposition of history and nature, he questions Kant's separation of the causally determined world of appearance and the intelligible realm of freedom in which action is not subject to natural causality. The echoes of theological debates about the cause of the universe are informative here. If everything in the world has a cause, what caused the universe, and what stops a regress of causes of the universe? The answer was often seen as God as the first cause, and this is echoed in the absolute, non-empirical status of Kant's notion of the subject's causality through freedom, as opposed to the relative status of all causes in the empirical world. So what is Adorno's alternative? The history of freedom. Adorno questions the idea that the subject's either having or not having a capacity for absolute beginnings is the key to freedom. Why should freedom be reducible to having a kind of on-off switch for doing X or not doing X that is not part of a causal chain and has nothing to do with specific empirical circumstances? Kant's attempt to separate the empirical individual from the transcendental subject comes up against a problem in any case of a decision. The empirical subject that makes those decisions, and only an empirical subject can make them, the transcendental pure, I think, would not be capable of having impulses, is itself a moment of the spatio-temporal, external world, and has no ontological priority to it. This is why the attempt to locate the question of freedom in it fails. Adorno often refers, when considering such questions, to the primacy of the objective with respect to understanding the life of human subjects. For it is on the sphere of the objective, on the organization of the world and the state of the world, that the extent to which the subject attains autonomy depends. Detached from the state of the world, autonomy is fictitious, or such a thin and abstract principle that nothing at all more can be said with it about the real and actual behavior of people. Sartre's insistence that even someone in a situation with no freedom to act at all remains somehow free because they have a choice over how they relate to their situation makes little sense to Adorno. Marcuse called out the nonsense of the philosopheme, that one could even inwardly accept or reject torture. The increased focus on freedom of the will arises at a specific moment in the development of modern bourgeois society, namely when the idea of universal determinism becomes central to the sciences, and the idea of the individual's will as self-determining is valorized in a way which is not present in the ancient world and in feudalism. While concern with freedom is present in many aspects of the history of Western philosophy, the concept of the will itself as concept of the alternative, freedom or unfreedom of the will, only belongs to a relatively late phase of philosophical reflection. As he says of Kant, it never occurred to him whether freedom itself, which is an eternal idea to him, could be historical, not just as a concept, but in terms of its content of experience. Whole epochs, whole societies did not only lack the concept, but the thing as well. The modern idea of freedom cannot be thought of in separation from its political and historical contexts. The objective social realm, therefore, is part of what is often seen as essentially interior to the subject. Philosophy's relationship to freedom can itself fall prey to a further dialectic. The more the theory urges freedom, the more the theory insists that human beings are free in themselves, that their will is absolutely free, that they are absolutely responsible for themselves, the more the theory lends itself to repression. In structurally unequal economic circumstances, freedom is often invoked to justify inequality on the grounds that everyone can supposedly work their way out of poverty. Such concrete instantiations of the issue are a further reason why Adorno is concerned at how the law can create injustice by the formal principle of equivalence. Moreover, couching the issue of freedom in terms of a metaphysical absolute leaves one with no way of understanding the role freedom plays in the history which leads to the Holocaust. Why does supposed human autonomy lead to repression and blind obedience? Despite his objections to how Hegel sees the law, Adorno concurs with his understanding of freedom as inseparable from human institutions. Hegel shows how freedom, which appears to us as if it were just a quality of subjectivity, as if its possibility could only be decided and judged in the subjective realm, actually depends on the objective, on the extent to which we are capable at all, via what we do as subjectively formally free beings, of influencing overwhelmingly structured institutional reality. In Adorno's sometimes hyperbolic view of the totality of modern society in the wake of the Holocaust, individual freedom has largely become a delusion that was destroyed by the structures which dominate the modern world. As he says in The Authoritarian Personality, the more our society tends to become integral, i.e., a thoroughly organized totality, the more the pressure increases that it exercises upon the comparatively impotent individual. This process has been part of the development of modern capitalism, at least since the 19th century. The crucial aspect of the process is that the actions of individuals bring about a system in which what those individuals intend has little bearing on what actually results from the system. What Adorno often refers to as the context of delusion, the world constituted through the system of commodity exchange, is a further example of why he thinks conceptions of subjective and objective have to be rethought. The autonomy of the individual is then so tied up with a system that what can appear to the individual as the exercise of freedom can actually be the product of determining factors of which they are not aware. Certain 21st century concerns can illustrate the point. the projection onto others of poor white people's real suffering and frustration often takes the form of a racism that makes them unable to realize that they are part of an economic and political system which has systematically impoverished them for decades. Focusing on the metaphysical question of whether such people have free will when they have little or no space for self-determination further underlines how freedom cannot be reduced to being something that resides solely in the subject. The modern concern with freedom itself derives from changes in the economic and social constitution of the objective social world, like the rise of bourgeois individualism, that happen independently of the will of individuals, so that one could say that in a very real sense, freedom gets mixed up in the context of determination. Moral life and the additional factor. If Adorno's points are taken seriously, the way philosophical discussion about ethics is often carried out can appear to be inadequate. If there is no right life in life that is wrong, people may be confronted with situations where there is no right course of action, because whatever they do may just perpetuate unjust social conditions. The choice between consequentialist theories that focus on the results of an action as what gives it its moral worth, and deontological theories that judge actions in terms of their accordance with norms, like duty, can look abstract in relation to the reality of moral situations in a world where so much is dominated by systemic pressures. Freedom necessarily presupposes the freedom of the whole, and cannot, as isolated freedom, thus without the freedom of the whole of society, even be thought. As such, the reason why the question of moral philosophy has become so problematic today is primarily that the substantiality of ethics, thus the possibility that a right way of living was already given and present in the forms in which the community exists, has become radically obsolete. But what, given the fact that the freedom of the whole of society is conspicuously absent, does Adorno propose with respect to how we should respond to modern moral dilemmas? Adorno does not think we can just abandon the usual concerns of moral philosophy, but the philosopher who proposes a moral theory has always to keep in mind the fallibility that results from their location in circumstances that are not wholly transparent to them. His concern is to show up the limits of theorizing about freedom and morality in relation to the reality of moral life, in order to avoid philosophy conspiring with self-deception. He criticizes the kind of thinking about freedom often encountered in analytical philosophy, which can lead to the following. In order conclusively, so to speak empirically, to make a decision on whether the will is free, situations have to be rigorously purged of their empirical content. Thought experimental conditions must be produced in which as few determinants as possible are noticeable. The trolley problem is a familiar example of this. Would you switch the track for a runaway railway trolley that would kill 5 people to a track that would kill just 1 person? What if stopping the trolley killing the 5 could be achieved by pushing a fat man off a bridge onto the line? The point is that nobody knows what they would do in such an already highly unlikely situation, because one does not know what else would be affecting one in the decision. Adorno, in contrast, cites empirical cases from history and literature that can be interpreted in differing ways to show why thought experiments cannot grasp the reality of moral life. The result is not a theoretical account of how to make moral decisions. The focus is instead on showing the contradictions involved in real dilemmas, in order not to exclude the contingencies they inevitably involve. He sums this up in the assertion that it cannot be prophesied, even of the most morally upright person, how they would behave under torture. this sort of approach might seem likely to paralyze any attempt to act, given that people will always be faced with contradictions, which may not be able to be resolved by a decision to act. Hamlet beckons, as Adorno himself suggests. Action, rather than mere conditioned or unreflective behavior, seems to involve some kind of reconciliation between a person's impulses and social norms. The subject only knows itself to be free to the extent that its action appears identical with it, and that is only the case with things that are conscious. However, just adhering to a norm is no guarantee that one will, in concrete circumstances, actually act in terms of it. For this to happen, something that is not given with the norm itself has to come into play, which he terms the additional factor, das Hinzutretende. People suffer from their knowledge because they have the experience that there is no longer a direct way into practice from this knowledge, but that one needs a third thing, precisely that element of irrationality, of what is not purely reducible to reason. He tells of meeting one of the surviving members of the 20th July plot to assassinate Hitler. The plotters had to ponder the terrible consequences for themselves of failure, the possibility that what they intended doing might make things even worse, the threat to their relatives in the event of failure, and a host of other factors. The survivor makes it clear that the situation in relation to Hitler was so unbearable that they felt compelled to act, but not for clearly formulated reasons. Rather, there was, Adorno contends, a moment of irrationality, that is, essentially atheoretical, which made them act. The additional factor cannot be subsumed into norm-based moral reflection. It therefore involves a connection between nature and freedom. For Kant, morality depends on the ability to resist natural impulses, and for Hegel, on the reconciliation of our natural and our social being. Adorno, in contrast, wants to include the possibility of natural impulses being part of the reality of moral life. Impulse, which is both intramental and somatic, drives beyond the sphere of consciousness to which it still also belongs. With it, freedom reaches into experience. And we are capable, by dint of this impulse, of getting into, leaping into, going into the objective sphere, which is otherwise obstructed for us by our own rationality. By trying to account for freedom in terms of the nature of human impulses, Adorno suggests he will be accused of invoking something merely determined. In order to respond to the fact that impulses can also be merely irrational causes of our actions, as well as part of freedom, Adorno develops a dialectical approach to freedom and nature, using aspects of psychoanalysis. We have already encountered the basic pattern of thought. In order to gain control of nature, the subject has to control its own impulses, which are part of its nature. And this gives rise to a contradiction. Whilst it is only with the development of consciousness at all that something like freedom becomes possible, at the same time, it is the development of consciousness that pushes freedom back into this archaic mimetic moment that is essential to it. Whereas Kant largely sees freedom in terms of opposition to somatic impulses, Adorno thinks this can be mere repression, and that real freedom would come from finding ways to allow these impulses to gain expression without being harmful. This cannot be achieved simply by the establishing of norms, because in any real situation there will be conflicts between norms that lead precisely to the situation that involves the additional factor. Norms, as we saw with respect to the law, can also become repressive by rigid application. a new categorical imperative. So how does Adorno conceive of a grounding of ethics? Kant famously seeks to do this on the basis of the categorical imperative, one formulation of which is, I ought never to act except in such a way that I can also will that my maxim should become a universal law. Adorno does not deny that some sense of conscience is part of our makeup as social beings, and Kant is relying on this to arrive at his imperative. However, conscience depends on norms that have arisen in a world of distorted social relations, and can, as Adolf Eichmann showed, be turned into forms of adherence to duty that are used to legitimize barbarism. Adorno argues that all the concepts in honor of freedom which are supposed in the Critique of Practical Reason to fill out the gulf between the imperative and people are repressive. Law, compulsion, deference, duty, causality from freedom corrupts the latter into obedience. A search for a universal foundation relies on reference to a single grounding principle. Like Kant's universalization of maxims for action via the categorical imperative. But actual moral decisions generally involve competing imperatives. Kant's absolute prohibition on lying comes up, for instance, as the novelist and political writer Benjamin Constant, 1767 to 1830, pointed out, against the situation where lying might save people's lives. Lying might actually, in some cases, lead to something worse than what it tries to prevent. But there is no sure way of knowing this, and Kant's strict separation of empirical and moral aspects of the dilemma does nothing to help here. Such dilemmas mean Adorno insists that moral justification has to respond to empirical, historical contingency. And this leads to his own version of a categorical imperative. Hitler enforced a new categorical imperative on humankind in the state of unfreedom, to organize their thinking and action in such a way that Auschwitz does not repeat itself, that nothing similar should happen. This imperative is just as resistant to being given a grounding as, in its time, the givenness of Kant's imperative. He claims that Kant just breaks off the philosophical argument by seeing the moral law as given rather than argued for. And this again suggests that right action is not to be purely resolved into theoretical requirements. It is then crucial to see how individual moral life is subject to pressures from a collectively constituted social, economic, and political world that sets the frame of the individual scope for action, and so can erode their ability to judge. The primacy of the objective social whole in relation to the subject is, he thinks, unavoidable. This entails an objective theory of society, where the supposed facts of conscious and unconscious modes of behavior of subjects are in many ways something derivative. The essential object of knowledge of society is its objective context, its structural laws, which individual human beings obey, even in their forms of reaction. Adorno is therefore concerned to warn against moral certainty and advocates learning in reflection on one's own, having been conditioned, Bedingtheit, to also allow legitimacy to what is different, and to feel that the true injustice is really always there where one assumes one is right and the other is wrong. He sums this approach up as follows. Moral certainty does not exist. To imply that it does is already immoral, a false exoneration of the individual from whatever might be termed ethical life. The ways in which modern societies are organized mean that individual action is always likely to result in something unintended of which the individual could not be aware. This might seem a rather feeble way for Adorno to advocate his categorical imperative to think and act such that nothing like Auschwitz could be repeated. However, he also makes it clear that after Auschwitz, we might not know what is the absolute good, the absolute norm, or even only what man or the human or humanity is, but we very well know what the inhuman is. The question is why modern societies are able to make their members oblivious to the inhuman, as is still apparent, for example, in the widespread antagonism in the contemporary world to the sufferings of refugees and racially oppressed people. Such antagonism is precisely linked to a moral narcissism that tries to blame such people for their own oppression, while relying on the sense that one's own life is not morally questionable. In the UK, this often takes the form of a refusal to look at the genocidal history of the British Empire that is still a major factor in enforced migration. And this refusal is often accompanied by the contention that other countries' history is just as murderous, as though this makes British history any less so. Adorno's insistence on the empirical, historical aspect of thinking about freedom results from his conviction that understanding moral life is tied up with social, economic, and political pressures that cannot be understood from the perspective of the isolated individual moral subject. Perhaps most importantly, he focuses on how modern culture can make people unable to see the reality of what they are doing and what they are involved in. His repeated target here is conformism, and the crucial issue is how the power of conformism comes about. In an era which can produce the likes of Bolsonaro, Orban, Modi, Trump, and other authoritarian politicians, Adorno's sometimes flawed analyses of the functioning of conformism in culture deserve renewed attention, as we will discuss in the next chapter.